We have a little practical exercise for everyone this afternoon, because I was thinking after the second day, the afternoon of the second day, it starts to get a little hard to sit and listen and listen and listen and listen, and you start to feel a little jumpy. So I was trying to think of another way to present the subject matter. And on the other side, I have to admit, in all honesty, that of all the people who have come to this retreat, the person who has benefited the most has been myself, because for the last month I have been reading and studying and trying to prepare something. So I have had to become, out of nervousness and fear, I've had to become immersed in the subject matter far more than anybody else who is present. Everybody else, as my husband is fond of saying, can fall asleep, but not the speaker. So the speaker gets, it is a known fact, the speaker gets the most benefit from a presentation, because their position is that they have to carry the most responsibility for that presentation. So I was thinking, I wished I could share with some of you what it's like to sort of dive into the Srimad Bhagavatam. And not to have some systematic form. Some people who are natural readers, they may say, well, I start at the beginning, I've read the first canto, second canto, and so on and so forth. But I have to admit in all honesty that I came to Krishna consciousness, and after 4 years, I was a mother. So I can understand what it's like to be a mother. And a mother means, at least this was my experience, that you shouldn't make your intelligence too keen. If you get too avid, then it's very difficult to do that service, because at least for younger children, it's quite mindless. It's just like having some pets. You have to feed them, make sure they're peaceful, sleep, and so on and so forth. But there's no intellectual satisfaction in it. So I wasn't so good at that part of the mothering phase, because I got restless and I found that it was too unstimulating. But as soon as I would get some stimulation, then I would even be worse, because then I would want to go do something else that was more according to how I would feel or how I would like to use my time. So then what happened was, this was the time when I was reading the Bhagavatam, and many was the time that out of boredom or frustration or despair or restlessness, or just when your mind just becomes dull, or just busy, 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 and you needed a break, I would pick up the Srimad Bhagavatam anywhere. And many times, I have to admit, I read from the back to the front. I would open up somewhere and I'd find a story. Oh, that's interesting. And I would start reading it. And then I would think, oh, I wonder what happened before that. So I'd go this way. Oh, that's very interesting. And I'd turn backwards and backwards and backwards until I'd get to the start. And then I'd start going the other way quickly through to try and figure out what I had been reading and find the end. And so my reading was very, very unorganized. So sometimes people have said to me, new devotees, feeling a little guilty, and I would admit certainly mostly ladies, because mostly I speak with ladies, they would say that, I'm just not that kind of person who can systematically read. So, you know, I'd say to them, have you finished the Bhagavatam? Sometimes they are devotees for a long time. I'd say, have you finished the whole of the Bhagavatam? Well, I said, you haven't read the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam? And that would shock me, but not so much because I was an intellectual who had systematically studied the Bhagavatam and recommended the same to others, but because I was so desperate in that particular stage where there was not much intellectual satisfaction, that I had taken shelter of the Bhagavatam informally in so many occasions, that the Bhagavatam I still have one of these 10-in-1 volumes that you sometimes see. And the writing is so small that I can't read it anymore. Yes, this one. And because I would read something interesting, then I would want to tell somebody, and I couldn't find it again. So because it was my book, I was this little Maya here, I would think, well, this is my book, so I can treat my book the way I want to treat my book. And so I would underline it very rigorously, usually with a pencil. I would go through and underline so many things. And sometime later, I went to Bombay, and there in the Juhu Beach Temple, if anyone visits, there's a museum of Srila Prabhupada's items. And there I noticed that there was a Bhagavad Gita that was Srila Prabhupada's. And it was very thickly underlined with little notations everywhere, because it was useful for his study. So that gave me some confidence that maybe I could recommend my abnormal ways to other people if they were not capable of going by the straight route. If they could do everything in the normal way, then I should be quiet. But if they were not able to, then they should take up in some way the association of the Bhagavatam. And I didn't take it up as an intellectual thing. I took it up because perhaps I would think I had more than less mental distress at various times of my life, and I needed to hear from somebody I could trust. And I needed to hear something that could replace the way I thought. And to go and ask another person, well, they might tell you something, but that's just their idea. It's a relative suggestion. I may not be like them. They may not agree with me. They may not understand my confusion. So that didn't necessarily become the healthiest, most beneficial way to replace the way of thinking that I was already possessed with. The best way seemed to be to hear from something that was very, very sound. In fact, beyond sound, transcendental and absolute. And if I could read for half an hour and find one sentence that struck me, I would feel like, whoa, that was really Krishna's mercy. I can keep that. That was a gift for me from my reading. So because I was reading informally, I didn't take long periods of time. I didn't read every day. But the reading developed a sense of relationship, up to the point that whenever something went wrong, the first thing I would do is get my Bhagavatam and I'd go and hide in a room and keep reading until I found something that pacified my mind. Because basically what it means when you say something goes wrong, it's some disturbance in the mind, either from the physical burden of life or something just from one's own nature, disposition or personality. So in this way, a relationship has developed. And this is over many years. And somehow or other, by Krishna's mercy and Srila Prabhupada's mercy, now is an opportunity to share what, through all those years of tedious, all due respects, tedious motherhood, which I found very difficult, that these habits that have developed have turned into something. So we should all start somewhere, because you don't know where it will end up. So thinking like this, I thought it would be very nice if you could also have an opportunity to take some time during the retreat to have the Bhagavatam and to read the Bhagavatam. Now, many of you, I'm aware, are actually very systematic, well-trained, self-disciplined, and you have studied the Bhagavatam very nicely. So for you, it will also be a joy. But for all of us, I think, we can benefit from some personal interaction in this way. So what I did was I took the 12 verses of Dhruva Maharaja's prayers. He offered 12 prayers to Lord Vishnu when he appeared. And I have put each one in an envelope. And in this envelope, there are some questions, and there is also some blank paper. And here there are some pens. Somewhere here there are some pens for anyone who needs them. Now that means we have 12 groups. And can anyone give me a suggestion? What's the best way, according to the Melbourne Yatra standards, to divide people into groups?
Number them?
I was thinking preferably, it is preferable to have the women separate than the men.
I prefer.
Okay, that was my thought as we sit. But because otherwise everyone has to start moving all around the room. So then, but it's a little difficult, I have 12. So what I can do maybe is say, in this section here, one. So you will have to do a little intelligent organizing too. Two, three, four, this little group here. Five, behind this group of ladies. Sweta, you can be with the boys, or you can be with the ladies, whichever you prefer. And then six, the ladies at the back. And then six here with the men. One in this group here. And then you will have to work out the rest. I'm sorry. Now, can you do that? Let me see who can do this. Please move into your groups. You can make your own groups if you like, but move into a small group. If you want to move into groups, my friends, you can do that also. Sweta. sweater. Yes. And later on, as I was telling you, he will feel quite sorry for that. And part of his desire, as he reflects later, was that he was angry. He was angry at his brother, and he was angry at his stepmother. Now the children will have to be quiet. Okay? A little bit quiet. Okay. So he was angry at his stepmother, he was angry at his brother. He wanted to retaliate what he considered to be an insult. And he didn't want to lose the opportunity to become a king. And not only that, he enlarged his material desire from just an ordinary king to becoming a king of a status that nobody had ever heard of before. A king who would be promoted beyond the universe in his kingship. So he came out to the forest and he performed these austerities, very short time, very severe and very short. And suddenly he opens his eyes and he sees outside of his heart, but standing before him, the person to whom he was worshipping, offering all his worship, and the person who could satisfy all the desires that he held within his heart. Now the children want to be a little quiet, or preferably they should be just at the back, if that's all right, because it's a little bit distracting. But otherwise they should stay in here, but if it's possible, just to a little towards the back. All right. But first, maybe we can ask some questions before they move, because you're in that group. All right. So then, he didn't know what to say when he saw the Lord. He was just a little child. We see these little children. They may be seated here by Krishna's arrangement. So you can see what little children are like. They just play. They're very simple. They're not very intellectual. They can't take part in what we just took part in. They simply make a little noise and play. This is natural for a child. And here's Dhruva Maharaj. He's seeing the Lord and he didn't know what to say. He just didn't know what to do. And so Krishna, Lord Vishnu, Krishna Garbha was the form of the Lord that appeared before Dhruva. He took his conch shell and he very gently touched this little child on the head. So we see that the children are playing. Imagine if somebody came in and they touched one of the little boys or little girls gently on the head and they suddenly became extremely eloquent and they stood up and they had tears in their eyes and they were offering beautiful prayers. We would consider them very fortunate. So in this way, Dhruva also, he became very fortunate. And these are his prayers. Now, can we find out where the group who has text 6 are? Is that your group there? All right, okay. So now in text 6, Glenn, maybe you can put these texts up. The verse can go up. Not the purport, but we can see the verse that the devotees were looking at. So you can quickly read this verse and also hear the answers that these devotees... This is not a right and wrong quiz. This is just to get some general inspiration and to share amongst the devotees in this way. So the question that was asked to these devotees, one was, what was the difference that Dhruva Maharaj perceived within himself? And how had he understood this difference? Can somebody answer for this group?
Before coming to this spiritual platform, his senses were sleeping. And as soon as he came to this spiritual platform, he understood the varying instructions and also it was the action of internal potency of the Lord, which woke him up. And so all his senses were spiritualized and he started speaking continuously.
So he felt as though he had always been sleeping until that point.
Yes.
And then by the spiritual potency of the Lord, he felt that now for the first time he had woken up. So this is something that we still perhaps are eager to experience ourselves. And we may find ourselves also that sometimes we feel quite sleepy. But if we receive this mercy of the Lord in any form, then we too can experience an enlivenment. All right. Verse number 7. I'm going a little quickly because, as I said, we wish to fit in a few more sections to this class. So I have a question for verse number 7, the devotees who did that particular verse. What was Dhruva Maharaj's understanding of the spiritual and the material energies? Yes?
The first thing we understood from Srila Prabhupada's purpose is that Dhruva Maharaj could understand the fact very nicely that energy and energetic are the same, and the energy cannot be separated from the energetic. So by this understanding, he could refute the Mayavadi philosophers, what the Mayavadi philosophers claim, that when the Lord is all pervading, he loses his personal identity, he doesn't have any personal identity. But here Dhruva Maharaj is establishing that the Lord doesn't become void or impersonal, but he becomes all pervading by his energy.
Okay.
And the second thing is, he could understand that this energy is basically spiritual because it is the Lord's energy. So since the Lord is all spiritual, the energy is also spiritual. But because it comes in contact with the material world temporarily, and therefore it is called as Maya or illusory energy. That was the second understanding which Dhruva Maharaj had.
Sir, yes, please continue. Yes, go on.
And we also understood that for everyone who are the devotees of the Lord, the energy acts, this energy acts as the external Maya energy.
Here's a very important point. For everybody else, here is the section that the devotees were reading from. It says that the material energy acts in various varieties in material bodies. In the case of devotees, the same energy is transformed into spiritual energy. This is possible because the energy is originally spiritual, not material. So for other people, we should note that this energy appears in the Maya form, in the form of delusion or forgetfulness of Krishna. But the same energy, when it comes to the devotees, it acts to enlighten them. It is the Lord's spiritual energy, but it becomes material when it comes in contact with non-devotional consciousness. All right, verse number 8. Thank you. Thank you. Verse number 8, the question I would like to ask is, how does Krishna reciprocate with his devotees? Yes, please. Yes, Veena.
Krishna is sitting in our heart as the Supreme Soul.
Yes.
So as we desire, he gives us, you know, directions from inside to serve him more and more with love and devotion. And for that, he makes the necessary ways and arrangements. Like Dhruva Maharaj had a desire to serve the Lord or worship the Lord, and he gave him the Nitya Narasimha, and through him he got the instruction how to serve him. And secondly, the degree of reciprocation of the Lord depends upon the degree of our surrender. As we surrender more and more, we reciprocate more and more with us. We know the very well known example of Draupadi. When she was dishonored by the Dushasana in assembly, she was trying to protect herself. Of course, she was praying to the Lord because she is a devotee. But until and unless she surrendered herself fully to the Lord, and then when she surrendered to the Lord fully, then Lord supplied her unlimited sari and protected her.
Thank you.
So the degree of reciprocation depends on the degree of surrender.
The reciprocation depends, thank you very much. The reciprocation depends on the degree of surrender. He reciprocates with the devotee, so we may feel sometimes he doesn't seem to be doing anything for me. So then we should examine what is my degree of surrender. And by that we can sometimes increase our degree of surrender and recognize, because then the material energy will become more spiritualized by that surrender. So verse 9, why did Dhruva Maharaj repent? Who is the, yes?
Dhruva Maharaj repented for many reasons. Number one, after seeing the Lord,
yes,
he was so much enamored, he no longer desired the original things which he wanted. It was just like glass for him. When he saw the Lord just like diamond, he no longer wanted the kingdom. And then he was horrified that once the Lord gave him the kingdom, that he would have to go back to doing mundane activities when he wanted only to serve the Lord at that point of time. So it became a sort of a pain for him to have to go back. Number two, he had also desired, as he said, he was angry at that time on his stepmother and brother and me, and he was really dependent that they would have to suffer.
Yes.
But at that point, he did not want them to suffer.
Yes.
And he really repented that he had asked, he was the Lord for material gain, which even hogs and other animals can even
get it easily.
He was thinking of praying for the Lord just for
thank you.
One day activity.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you. All right, now verse 10. What is the goal of the karmi? And why is it described as being a degraded goal? Why is the karmi considered degrading? Degraded. Who has the answer to this one? Yes, Prabhu. Yes, Vijit.
The karmi's primary aim is to favor themselves to the higher planetary systems.
To the higher planetary systems. Yes.
And that's their prime aim, and, which is obviously significantly less blissful than some transcendental bliss gained by pure devotees or to an extent the yogis who at least meditate upon Lord Vishnu.
Is there something else about that it's less blissful? Is there something else? There's another point?
The reason why it is also, in fact, it's degraded is because this doesn't lead to the
they come down again. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Anything that goes up with that kind of philosophy or phase of devotion comes back.
Comes back down. Yes. Yes. This is a very important point, that their aim is they want to go up. It's like an elevator, right? You want to go up to the top, but then you have to come down again. So therefore their goal is considered not very, very valuable. Even the yogis, in their meditation, they want something that has an eternal aspect to it. But those who are just, what is a karmi? What is not an intellectual definition, but what could you call a karmi?
Sense gratification.
Sense gratification, what else?
Fruitive
activities. What does fruitive activities mean?
Material
desires. What does that mean?
They desire themselves.
They want. Yes, this is the point. They want. They want. They're doing something. They want the result for themselves. Whatever they're doing it so they can reap the fruit of it. Just like if you think fruitive activity is if I put a tree, I plant an apple tree, and it grows up very nicely. I want to eat the apples. Why else would I plant the tree? What other reason is there? In fact, practically speaking, in a world that has no sense of Krishna consciousness, there's no other reason to act. It's just logical. No one acts unless they're going to get a result. Who would act otherwise? So you plant the tree, you eat the fruit. What's the difficulty? So this is fruitive activity, but that means that if you do the act and you want the result, when the result, because karma is very subtle and intricate and complicated. For example, when you walk on the street, you kill so many very small living entities who may be underfoot. Or even when you breathe, there are so many bacteria in the air. So if it's coming all on your account, you say, I want everything on my account. I did this, give it to me. You get it all. And so, therefore, it's considered not very intelligent, because you may get some good result, but you'll also get some bad result. Or, as Vishvajit Prabhu was pointing out from this verse, they can become elevated, but they must come down again when the results of their pious activities have finished. They'll use them all up. It's like, frequent flyer points. They use them all up. And when they've used them all up, they have to come back. No more. So this is why it is not recommended. And it's very difficult to pass beyond this conception that I do things and the result is mine. I did it, it's mine. We know the story of the two birds on the tree. One bird is watching, the other bird is busy eating the fruit. And when the fruit tastes very bitter or sour, the other bird is just watching, waiting, to make some interaction with the bird who is tasting. So this is the position of the karmis. So we have come from there. We are now in the beginning stages of bhakti, of devotional service. We still have further to go. So we should move forward. The further we get away from that, the further we are on the safe side, moving towards advancement in devotional service. Text 11. Pure devotees relish hearing the topics of the Lord. So here is the question I chose to ask you. What is the process for crossing the ocean of material existence? Who can tell us that?
The process of crossing the ocean of material existence is by devotional service, which is only possible through the association of pure devotees, and which can become easy. One becomes addicted to the Lord's pastimes and qualities. Dhruva Maharaj also explicitly said that devotional activity is just like the waves of an incessantly flowing river, which is, so devotional service in association of pure devotees is how we can cross the ocean of material existence.
Association. And what happens in the association?
One's devotion for the Lord becomes mature.
And this is, I would read from the purport, it describes what happens when one's devotion becomes mature. So that we can all see, is my devotion, has it matured yet? Or is it mature yet? Dhruva Maharaj is asked this question. You may be very happy in the association of devotees, but what's your plan for crossing the ocean of material existence? In other words, how are you going to get out of the material world? You're happy all together, but what's your plan? Dhruva Maharaj answers that it is not very difficult. This is not very difficult. He clearly says that this ocean can be crossed very easily if one simply becomes mad to hear the glories of the Lord. So this is what we wish would take place within our heart, that as Sweta was saying, by the association, no other way than the association of exalted devotees, and from hearing from them, if this madness to hear about the glories of the Lord should take place, we would be very fortunate. Thank you, Sweta. So verse 12, by associating with a pure devotee, one becomes detached from everything. What is the special advantage in devotional service? That's interesting, because sometimes that doesn't sound like a great thing, that you're not very much attached to the body. But imagine how much time would be saved if one wasn't very attached to the body and the mind. All the happiness that wouldn't distract us, and the distress that wouldn't also cause us to act this way and that way in order to mitigate the same. So both in devotional service, a devotee is not only enjoying the transcendental pastimes of the Lord by hearing and chanting and glorifying them, but just as Jamuna Acharya said, they are not very much attached to their bodies, unlike yogis who want to do so much exercise because they want to keep their body very fit and strong for their own purposes. That doesn't mean, of course, that a devotee should not keep their body fit and strong, but not for their own purposes. They should keep their body fit and strong so that they can go on in their development of their Krishna consciousness. Verse 13. This is quite a significant verse. So the first question is, what concept is expressed by Dhruva Maharaj in this verse?
In this this was the concept here, is that through his material energy, God has created the entire universe and all its material creation. And also he has created this universe. He is within the universe and he is simultaneously outside the universe. And the second thing is that he is unconceivable. It is only through his mercy and our sincere endeavors we can understand him and serve him. And if we are not serving him directly, we are serving the inferior energy of the Lord when we are serving our senses and we are living all the things.
Thank you. Thank you. Verse 14. Dhruva Maharaj offers prayers in complete, offers obeisances in complete knowledge of the Lord. What two things increase one's atheism?
Just reading from the Sattva Nukshita Prabhupada, the two things identified are the reluctance to accept the Shastras.
Yes?
Reluctance to accept the authority of the Shastras.
Okay. Reluctance to accept the authority of Shastra and
lack of experience in the absolute truth.
Lack of experience of the absolute truth create atheism. This is interesting because sometimes we find, as we go on, just as sometimes when you're performing some kind of an activity, you come across some kind of an impediment. Sometimes we see that there are little pockets of atheistic thought that have been created here and there within our consciousness, and we hit one. Or we're placed in a position where it becomes exposed to us. Atheism means, basically, that we don't believe that there's anyone who's actually in control of the universe. We don't accept that. So over millions and millions of lives, we have developed some, maybe some favorable things, and certainly some unfavorable things. So these are the two, you could say, these are the two primary causes of our materialism, atheism, godlessness. The first one, again? Yeah, first one?
The first one was the reluctance to accept the authority of the Shastras.
When we perceive in ourselves reluctance to accept the authority of Shastra, this is one. And?
Lack of experience in the absolute truth.
Due to a lack of experience in the absolute truth, we may become doubtful. We may become covered by this godless, this sense that there is no God, there is no one in control, and therefore I should act to do whatever I want. Then we become fruitive. And when we become fruitive, then, as we heard, we become degraded. Now, the next one. Thank you very much. Verse 15. What is an atheistic argument for denying the supremacy of the Lord?
The argument that Prabhupada gave was that he sleeps and wakes up, and similarly we sleep and wake up, and that the other one was like he appears and disappears, so it's similar to our birth and death. So it appears that from his activities that we are the same, that we do, he does
things like we do things. This is a very important point, because when we first become conscious, Krishna conscious, we're attempting to become Krishna conscious, there's a tendency to see the world around us, our family, our work, everything else, as very real and tangible, and the spiritual subject matter to be something somewhat hazy. It's kind of like a fuzzy. We hear it, it's not that we're arguing, but it's not as tangible. Like, we have a sense that Krishna's there, he's merciful, but I can see you all. I can talk individually with you. I can see you laugh or smile or walk out of the room. I can witness very directly all your physical dealings. But I don't have that sense of accessibility to Krishna. So then there's a tendency to think that the world as we know it is real, and that the ideas that we have about God have come as a result of thinking about ourselves. Well, we're like this, so he might be like that. We lend him things of our own. projection, that he's something like us. But we become the one who's kind of real. And he's the one who's a bit ethereal. But gradually, by hearing, we change that concept. And the new concept is that we begin to understand that the spiritual world is actually tangible. And as we were talking in the previous class, my husband was mentioning, if you're riding in a plane and you see those beautiful puffy white clouds and you go to take a dive out of the window, where will you land? In the cloud, or will you fall down? So those beautiful, real, tangible, formed clouds, they look substantial, but they're not. So one gradually, this transition, as one becomes to the platform of Nista and higher, there's a transition takes place, and the spiritual world starts to become very, very real. And the material world seems quite flimsy and not very substantial at all. So this may be something for us to look forward to. But it is said in Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur that the same way that now we may be all sitting in this room trying to concentrate and the mind will go away. Have you all had experience of this? The mind goes away to another subject. Something worldly, something about myself, something about somebody else in the room, something about today, tomorrow, last year, next life, somewhere. It goes away. And we don't know, we can't perceive when it leaves this transcendental subject matter and it goes back towards the material. So when one becomes advanced in this process by practice and practice, one comes to a point where one is busy in one's daily affairs and doesn't notice when the mind has suddenly wandered to Krishna. So we're given an example using something we can perceive right now, this wandering mind, that there will come a stage by application where our mind will pull and wander in the same way towards Krishna. And we will struggle to keep our mind on the things here. We will do the best we can, but our mind will be dragging us in this direction, whereas now it is dragging us in the other way. All right. Now I'm going to go, what's the next one? Verse 16. Explain the connection between vidya, avidya, and devotional service. Who is answering on this group? Yes, Prabhu.
In this context, avidya is defined as the conception that the impersonal, that Brahman is impersonal and the Lord Himself is impersonal. There is nothing beyond Brahman. That is called as avidya.
Yes.
And vidya is the complete knowledge of Sachidananda Vigraha, the personal form of the Lord, and the Lord is not alone, he is along with his creative energies. So that is vidya.
Okay.
And the process which takes one from avidya to vidya is devotional service, and this realization is in proportion to one's quality and quantity of devotional service.
Thank you very much. So this is very important. Avidya to vidya. If you want to come to knowledge, avidya, for those who are English speakers, means of course ignorance, and vidya means transcendental knowledge. The process between them, the bridge that you go by to get across to the other side, is devotional service. And the last question, and this is a very important verse actually, how is the Lord merciful to one who worships Him with a motive? Is anyone to speak on that? Yes.
The Lord is so merciful that not only does He fulfill the desires of a devotee who is driven by ignorance and desires for material benefits, but He also gives such a devotee all protection, just as a cow gives milk to a newly born calf. And Prabhupada explains, Krishna gives intelligence to those who constantly serve Him so that they may gradually approach Him. Krishna gives the guidance.
Krishna gives them the guidance. He gives them guidance. What else does He give them?
Intelligence.
What else does He give them? The main thing He gives them.
Protection.
How is He merciful? He protects one who worships Him with a motive, one who has desires in his heart, something else other than to please Him. He gives them all protection. Because they're very vulnerable, Somebody who has a motive is vulnerable. Why are they vulnerable? Does anyone know? Yes?
They can get distracted from the main goal of Krishna.
Yes, thank you. They can get easily distracted from the main goal of Krishna consciousness. What if they get the thing that they want? So he protects them. He protects them. Sometimes he protects them by giving it. And sometimes he protects them by not giving it. But he personally protects a devotee if they have some material desires. I will read that little section. The Lord is so merciful that not only does he fulfill the desires of a devotee who is driven by ignorance and desires material benefit, but he also gives such a devotee all protection, just as a cow gives milk to a newly born calf. So what a sweet example, a cow giving milk to a newly born calf. We should feel ourselves that we should really take shelter of his protection, because that is a very sweet and gentle analogy that is being given. We should have confidence that he will protect us. Now, because of the time factor, I would like to go very quickly to the little puppet show, and you can see this pastime. There's many more things could be said and shared, but our time is limited. So we will see now the puppet show of the pastime of Dhruva Maharaj.